Yeah, and there'll be more. There'll be more, I promise.
All right, we'll be back at you next week.
Okay, and thanks for staying tuned, and you stay tuned to KBOO, because we'll be the information source for most of you.
Staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Coming up next on Local Politics, KBOO News Director Althea Billings presents a Rose City retrospective.
KBOO Community Radio is working with Beautiful Portland to collect socks and blankets for those who are sleeping outside this winter. There is a collection box in the lobby of KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, between Burnside and Ankeny. Donations are accepted Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2020 Portland Mochitsky Festival on Sunday, January 26th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Viking Pavilion in Portland. The Mochitsky Festival celebrates the New Year by sharing Japanese-American culture with the community. The festival features hands-on activities for all ages, cultural foods, vendors, and a wide variety of demonstrations and performances, including taiko drumming, Japanese dance, storytelling, mochi pounding, martial art demos, and much more. Again, that's the 2020 Portland Mochitsky Festival on Sunday, January 26th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Viking Pavilion, 930 Southwest Hall Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Listening to a special KBOO broadcast, Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years under Trump. Today, we will be bringing you retrospective programming from a variety of angles so that you are prepared for the 2020 election season. I'm Althea Billings, and this hour we are diving into local politics. This is a Rose City retrospective. A decade is a lot of time to digest, so we're biting off a more manageable chunk of time, 3 years, starting after the 2016 election. In this short hour, not everything can be covered, but with the benefit of hindsight, we can look at the past and see some patterns emerge. One that is important to address up top is the rise of white nationalism entering the mainstream, emboldened by Trump's xenophobic, racist, and isolationist rhetoric. Portland has been an emblem of the struggle against white nationalism on the nation's stage, with frequent clashes between the Vancouver-based alt-right group Patriot Prayer and local anti-fascist protesters. At the very least locally, there is not a strong sentiment that there were good people on both sides. The story that is told by that struggle is not finished. Now, the legal consequences are playing out in court. This morning, jury selection is slated to begin for the trial against Jeremy Christian, the man who stabbed two people on a MAX train in 2017. His victims were defending two young women who he had been harassing for appearing to be Muslim. While people of color in Portland and around the country have certainly known that this type of hatred exists, the public clashes and public casualties have made the issue more present for white progressives. Just last week, two of the six Patriot Prayer members on trial for inciting a riot in May 2019 have pled guilty, while the others will still stand trial. These moments are not from the distant past, and we should keep them in mind as we move into the 2020 election, be that on the local, state, or national level. To help digest the last 3 years, I spoke to Alex Zielinski, the news editor of the Portland Mercury. Let's listen. So we are here speaking today with the news editor of the Portland Mercury, Alex Zielinski. Alex has been editing the Mercury since March of 2018 and focuses specifically on local politics in her column, The Hall Monitor. So welcome, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So today we're talking the last 3 years in Portland. So what have been some of the standout moments for you when we're thinking about the last 3 years?
Yeah, I think the changing kind of politics and policies around protests in Portland in wake of the Trump election, kind of the the emotions that were brought out after that election, and the conflicting perspectives that kind of used Portland streets as a sometimes a battlefield, were pretty remarkable in the past 3 years. Same with people who have joined city council since 2016, 2017. We're seeing a big shift in kind of the classic institutional politicians who are sitting on city council, and we have more activist figures and more, I guess you'd consider them to be more lefty and more radical figures on city council who aren't traditionally politicians. And along with that, I mean, a lot of things that are reflected on the national stage, like housing insecurity and job insecurity, being addressed locally with kind of new and interesting policies that I think other cities are looking towards us, how we're addressing it. Same goes for homelessness and kind of the ever challenging fight to figure out the best way to help people who don't have homes in Portland. Those stand out. I don't know if those are like the biggest ones, but when I think about the past 3 years and I think about my time covering politics so far, those are the ones that stand out the most.
So let's start talking about protests. Obviously, in the 3 days following the election when Trump won in 2016, you had major protests mm-hmm. in Portland, riots, mm-hmm. some would say. and then after the election, after the inauguration, you had the Women's March. Mm-hmm. So how do those strike you in retrospect?
I think, and this is probably also felt on the national level, but there's still a really strong dynamic and difference between what a Women's March is and what that stands for and how that was organized versus pretty much every other protest in Portland. And a lot of people point to, look how successful and how nonviolent the Women's March was. A lot of people in law enforcement like to point to that as a really positive, nonviolent coalescing of people, which it certainly was. But it's also used as a polar opposite of most of the protests we've seen in Portland in the past 3 years, which have really centered on members of kind of the fringy alt-right, far-right activists, people who are in allegiance with groups like Patriot Prayer out of Vancouver and Proud Boys and Three Percenters and kind of your white supremacist adjacent folks who won't necessarily say they are, but have a lot of friends who kind of believe in those ideals. A lot of those people coming to Portland who know that Portland is particularly liberal, particularly anti-Trump compared to other cities in the country, and coming to kind of stir things up. And a lot of these protests that we've seen since Trump's election are kind of butting heads between far-right and radical and progressive radical groups, and even like mainstream progressive folks. I think in the very beginning of the post-Trump election, a lot of the people you saw coming out were pretty, people describe them as rioters, people all dressed in black with faces covered, the classic like anti-fascist or Antifa personalities. And now that Trump has been in power for a good amount of time and folks are realizing that this is the coalition we want to be behind, it seems to be these anti-fascist and progressive groups seem to be attracting more kind of middle and moderate folks. I think looking at the way the city, at least from my perspective, seeing how the city kind of polices and monitors these protests is the most interesting, because it's always changing and it's always, you know, there's it's more interesting to it's always changing in the way that, police might, it's kind of up to them to choose when to show up and place themselves physically in between these groups of protesters, when to dress all in like kind of quote unquote riot gear, all armored up, ready for a riot. or when they decide to use quote-unquote less lethal weapons and rubber bullets against protesters who are acting unwieldy, when to shut a protest down, who to arrest. A lot of these questions have come up in court after protests and after folks have been arrested, wondering, you know, is Portland really doing all it can to protect the civil liberties of its citizens, but also the civil rights of the people who come into the city and try to stir things up. And that's been a contentious issue among city leadership since the start.
Right. And so in thinking about police treatment of protesters, what sort of moments stick out for you about that?
Yeah. There was a particular protest in August 2018 that drew a lot of people to Portland from outside of just the Pacific Northwest and down to the waterfront. It was a kind of classic. For a lot of these protests, it's not entirely clear what the actual the focus is. It's just kind of like finding a public stage to spout people's beliefs or anger against the left. And that this was another instance of that. It was probably the last protest where there was significant like use of force used against protesters from police officers who, there was at one point a huge group of Antifa adjacent protesters who kind of got in the way between police officers and police officers' cars that they had abandoned to go investigate something. To get back to their cars and to try to like create a path, police ended up shooting a number of people with rubber bullets. There are a handful of cases that are still kind of whirling through the criminal justice system right now, defending the people who were hit. And I think more recently, one that really took a ton of, garnered a lot of national attention was a protest led by the National Organization of the Proud Boys, the kind of alt-right, largest kind of well-known alt-right men's rights group in the country. And they came to Portland. They brought a lot of their supporters from all over the country to Portland here to protest, mostly to protest the way that our mayor, Ted Wheeler, has the way he responded to a large occupation outside of our ICE headquarters in Portland.
Right.
And they thought it was inappropriate and unfair to local law enforcement, and so the Proud Boys came to protest that. A lot of people were really afraid that it would lead to more violence than we've seen in a long time in Portland. And the city kind of went out of its way to make sure it had a ton of law enforcement to protect kind of both sides of groups and make sure nothing outrageous happened. And it was successfully, I know, quote unquote, safe. The optics of it weren't great. The police ended up kind of ushering the Proud Boys across a closed down bridge, making it look like they were kind of being given special treatment. But in the end, it smartly drew kind of those folks away from, creating kind of like violent clash with the Antifa group.
Right. And so let's talk about the police more generally, perhaps. So 2017 was when the DOJ settled with the Portland police about their treatment towards folks with mental illness. How have we seen that play out in the past couple of years?
It's been rocky. We've seen, I think this past year, 2019, was saw the highest number of people with mental illnesses being shot and killed by police officers since 2010, which was actually when the DOJ initially came to Portland to investigate. So on paper, it doesn't look great. Meanwhile, there's a lot of new training and a lot of new programs in place to make sure that police are, you know, more up, more aware of, you know, signs of people with mental illness and know the best way to de-escalate situations that isn't done. I think the police would say that the reason there are still so many fatal encounters is, well, twofold. One is that the police force is hasn't grown as they'd like it to when it comes to the number of officers who are able to come out and help. For the past couple of years, the chief of police have been really pushing the city to expand the number of officers on the bureau. And secondly, at least after the last police shooting of a homeless man who was in crisis, the bureau has really said, you know what, this is, we're doing as much as we can, but there's a mental health crisis here that goes beyond our power. That's really like the system. The mental health system in Portland is broken, and we're being used as this band-aid to kind of come in and help calm people who haven't been given the care or help that they need, which is, you know, in some ways is really true, that there is a huge need for more behavioral health care services in the state and the city, and I think everyone knows that. But it was a little remarkable to hear that coming from the chief of police to say, well, this is not really our problem. This is the best way that we can handle it is killing someone. Right. So we're about to, I think in the next, maybe the next month or two, a federal judge is going to review and do his like kind of annual check-in on how the police have been doing and how, you know, if they've been meeting the standards of the settlement agreement. According to the police bureau, they're there. They've met all. They've checked all these boxes. I wouldn't argue that they're not. But I think that, you know, meeting the settlement agreement goals of, you know, creating new programs and it's all about kind of setting expectations, but it's not about really the outcomes. It's not saying, you know, don't kill people who are in mental health crisis. Like there's really. That's not a measure that they're looking at. They're looking more at what are we doing to prevent future like fatal interactions. And I think, and so the city's hoping that they're going to be cleared of this settlement agreement in the next few months. And I don't doubt that that will happen. It certainly doesn't say that we've repaired everything that's wrong with the police bureau and with the way that they treat people in mental health crises, or they disproportionately treat people of color, which is also kind of part of the, or people who are houseless. It's certainly a laundry list that still needs to be addressed.
Right. And so in the past 3 years, to what extent do you think sort of, I guess, the public's conception of what the police should be doing has crystallized in light of all of these issues?
I think that can be really best illustrated in the election of the new city commissioner, Joanne Hardesty. I think she embodies what her beliefs around the police are, what a lot of Portlanders and other politicians think is the smartest way to move forward, which is she specifically has spent her year in office putting efforts towards kind of creating a program that a program that when you call 911, if someone calls 911 because there is someone in a mental health crisis, but it doesn't seem like they're going to be violent, or someone who is homeless who seems to be kind of in distress, something that's just like a lower level behavioral crisis, instead of dispatching police officers under this new program that's a pilot right now, the city and 911 dispatchers would send out a behavioral health expert along with someone who, with a fire bureau who's trained in basic EMS, CPR, and medical first responder. And I think while that response, you know, isn't be all end all to fixing the way that the police are interacting with people in mental illness, it's what the public and it's a start towards what the public is really Now shifting towards, which is realizing that, hey, yeah, like we now know enough people, we have enough friends of friends who have had terrible interactions with the police, who have mental illness, and either leads to them dying or leads to them being sent to prison or being sent to a mental institution where it's like this resources that are really low. What we need to be doing is actually connecting these people to resources in that keep them in their community, that keep them in their city, finding ways to stop kind of the hemorrhaging of whatever crisis they're in before it's this fatal one.
Let's talk a little bit about homelessness and the affordable housing crisis in Portland. What have we seen over the past 3 years?
We have seen the homeless population in Portland continue to grow alongside the amount of affordable housing options continue to shrink or at least stay at the same level. The average rent of one bedroom apartment in Portland has increased, stayed the same, but it's continued to creep. It hasn't. There's certainly, like in the economic side of things, there certainly hasn't been any change in how expensive it is to live in Portland. But we have seen a lot more of advocacy. A lot more work towards strengthening tenant rights and strengthening the rights of people who are right on the edge of homelessness, which I think is a really, really a huge population that we don't really see or talk about as often because it's personal and it's not people sitting out in the streets who are homeless. It's people who are maybe like one sick day away from being evicted, or one car accident, or one who knows what, one divorce, or one domestic violence incident away from living on the streets. And so the city has been putting a ton of effort through a major housing bond in 2017, another large like regional housing bond in 2018 to go towards not just creating affordable housing, but creating supportive affordable housing, which is the kind that really helps people afford their rent, but also helps give them the tools to make sure they aren't just that one missed paycheck away from being houseless, making sure people can stay in their homes. And it's complicated because it's really different for different people. Sometimes that's providing, behavioral health resources that are more accessible, or providing daycare for their kid, or providing job search help. It shows you the discussions that have been happening in City Hall over this have been really nuanced and interesting, and it's not just one solution kind of problem. It's really cobbled together. At the same time, the population of homeless people in Portland, there's no easy path. There's no immediate fix to getting people off the streets. There still is a limited number of shelter beds, and a limited number of people who actually feel comfortable staying in a shelter. At the same time, the average age, according to the last kind of census count of houseless people, the age of people who are homeless is getting older. A lot of people who are, baby boomer age and above, who are definitely getting sicker and staying sicker more than people who are in a home, and people who are staying, who are quote unquote chronically homeless, which is people who just have a really hard time getting out of the cycle of being homeless. And so over the past 3 years, there has been a lot of interesting and kind of new solutions, or at least attempts to solve kind of what has been happening here in Portland. I think the business community has been, part of the business community has been a little bit more receptive to like being part of the solution rather than just fighting the number of, homeless people who are, ruining their business somehow by existing in front of it. And there has been progress in that conversation.
Right. And I get the sense that sort of the community consciousness of what it means to be homeless and what impacts that has become a bit more mm-hmm. nuanced, I think, especially with the conversation around sweeps,
mm-hmm.
Evicting people from their campsites, taking their belongings.
Yeah, and kind of who those people are. I think it's really easy for people to see one person who is homeless and assume that's everyone. And meanwhile, there's thousands, at least over 1,000 Portlanders who are homeless, and a lot of them are people who are, a lot of them are families, a lot of them are people, kids who are living in cars with their family or sleeping on couches of friends. And I think as more of those populations become more visible, and there's more conversations about who's being impacted by these, people are becoming a little bit more aware that it's certainly nothing that someone wants to do by choice. There's a lot of conspiracies that are worth debunking, but a problem that cannot be solved overnight.
You are listening to a day of special programming, Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years. So far, my guest, the news editor of the Portland Mercury, Alex Zielinski, and I have discussed some of the major issue areas that got a lot of attention in Portland since 2017. There were 18 major protest events in 2017 alone, ranging from the March for Science in April to protests against the travel ban, ICE, and Trump himself. Portland saw a real push and pull in these protests, with demonstrators, counter-demonstrators, and police coming face-to-face. The attention these protests received and the escalation that was witnessed helped to move the needle on public opinion, especially around policing. That change in opinion may yet result in policy change as the police union negotiations get underway later this year. The Portland Street Response Program, introduced by Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, is in its pilot phase, but it has the potential to diffuse and de-escalate 911 calls related to people experiencing homelessness. After this short break, we will talk more about Commissioner Hardesty and City Hall. This is a Rose City Retrospective. Stay with us.
Let us be lovers, we'll marry our fortunes together. I've got some real estate here in my bag. So we bought a pack of cigarettes and Mrs. Wagner pies and walked off to look for America. I said as we boarded a Greyhound in Pittsburgh, Michigan seems like a dream to me now. It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've come to look for America, laughing on the bus, playing games with the faces. She said the man in the gabardine suit was a spy. I said be careful, his bow tie is really a camera. Toss me a cigarette, I think there's one in my raincoat. Smoked the last one an hour ago. So I looked at the scenery. She read her magazine, and the moon rose over an open field. Kathy, I'm lost, I said. Though I knew she was sleeping, I'm empty and aching and I don't know why. Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for America. All come to look for America. To look for.
That was America by Simon and Garfunkel. Let's jump back into my conversation with the news editor of the Portland Mercury, Alex Zielinski. So let's talk about City Hall a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
What have been sort of, I don't know if you would call them innovations, that was the word that came to my mind, but sort of the major changes in City Hall. Obviously the election of Joanne Hardesty
mm-hmm.
is a major one.
Mm-hmm. The election of Joanne Hardesty was historic, if not historic, because she was the first African-American woman to be elected to City Hall, which is, you know, only really one part of her personality. She's also this longtime activist and kind of police accountability advocate who came into City Hall with a set agenda that she's remarkably been able to hammer out pretty quickly in her first year. And seeing her, you know, cross the barrier there has been a lot more smoother than people have thought, I think. The same time that Trump was elected at that same, in the same, the same election in which Trump was elected, City Hall also gained another new commissioner who never had been involved in politics, Commissioner Chloe Udaly, who was really not expected to win. She didn't have a ton of campaign funding. She was a longtime bookstore owner and really active in the artist community, but didn't have that kind of institutional funding and investment that the incumbent that she unseated had. And so, but she really came in as an advocate for tenants, for renters, and as someone who was a single mother with a kid with disabilities who really needed affordable housing and felt like she and her community of, like, you know, in Portland, which Portland was kind of, you know, has been really proud of for a while, were being edged out of the city because of the prices. She came in on that tide of the wave of support from a lot of other people who were feeling the same way. And since then, she's helped lead a number of pretty remarkable tenant rights policies, including one that makes it mandatory for any landlords that evict people to, if they don't have a number of pretty limited reasons for doing so, they have to make sure that they give that tenant relocation funding to find a new place to live. And, you know, now she's in the midst of pushing something that will limit the amount of screening and historically kind of racist and biased background checks that landlords do against tenants. And all of this has just been in hopes of making even the ability to rent in Portland, not even own a house, but to rent in Portland and afford it, a little bit more of an equal and a fair game for other people. And I think she's now running for re-election, and I think she still has the momentum from that. Renting is still very challenging in Portland, and I think her work on that has been pretty resolute and empowering to people in City Hall. More recently, a change in an unexpected kind of change in City Hall. We just lost a longtime commissioner who had been seen kind of as the a mediator and kind of a good centrist, or at least a moderate person on a pretty progressive city council, Nick Fish, who passed away from cancer in early January. Which has opened up a remarkably dramatic race to fill his spot. And we also have the mayor's seat opening up for re-election as well. So City Hall in 2021 could look remarkably different than it is right now based on the amount of different changing seats and changing leaderships and what's a pretty small five-person commission.
Right. And so I want to talk a little bit about the city commission structure, because, like, as you mentioned, Chloe Udaly, Joanne Hardesty, they had campaigns that or issue areas in particular that they were very committed to, and that is what helped propel them to sit on the city council rather than being elected by a particular area. Can you tell me a little bit about the city commission structure?
Yeah, Portland has a really odd form of government. It wasn't odd 100 years ago, but it's called a commission form of government that Portland is the only city of its size that currently has, that still has this kind of setup. It's been kind of phased out in most other big cities because it's, rooted in classist and kind of racist ideals of, instead of like a normal kind of representative-based government like the Oregon House of Representatives or Capitol or the U.S. Congress, it's not, which in those bodies you have people elected to represent certain regions, and they are expected to live in that region and to speak for the people who live in those geographical boundaries, regardless of what their politics are or what their, what they really care about fighting for in the civic space. And under a commission form of government, people are not elected by certain areas of the city, to represent those people's voices. They're elected basically by the entire city, kind of whoever gets the most votes. When a city council seat is open, they win and they get that seat. And so historically, that means the people who can fundraise the most and people who have the most name recognition, who've been in government the longest, and people, they look at the ballot and they're like, well, that's someone I've heard of. They win that seat. It's not going to be the younger kind of upstart who's maybe born in part of town and really well known to that part of town in particular, but maybe folks in the West Hills might not know who they are. So that has kind of laid the path for what Portland's government has looked like up until the recent history, when people like Joanne Hardesty and Chloe Daly have really put in the extra effort, more than someone, say, in a more traditional representative-based form of government, to kind of buck the establishment and get the votes, collective votes needed to win. And so while they have been successful in that, there's still a really active conversation around changing Portland's form of government to better represent the city and give people better chances to have a shot at representing the city. I think at the same time, the city has tried to create ways to fix the problems that come with that style of government while not fixing the style of government, like introducing publicly financed campaigns, a program where if someone who's running for election gets enough, I think it's like less than 250 donations or yeah, less than 250 individual donations from people that are under $250, they can start having their campaign contributions matched by the city, but they have to be under a certain amount of funding. So basically encourages people who might not be able to get the huge like $10,000 checks from a business organization to run. At the same time, another piece of this this government, instead of representing regions, commissioners are actually more, it's almost like that they're the heads of huge city bureaus, like million-dollar city bureaus. So you have commissioners who their main job is running the Transportation Bureau, and they're allowed to do that in whatever political way that they're, they see best fit, which, critics say that means whoever is in charge of Parks and Rec is going to care less about other parts of the city and only care about their issue compared to other commissioners, which can be kind of a biased and contentious argument.
Right. And that, commissioners have both the administrative side of things to take care of as well as the legislative, mm-hmm. versus a typical city council where you are from your district. You care about that particular district, mm-hmm. because they elected you, mm-hmm. and it is up to either the council manager or the mayor who then carries out the administrative and executive
right.
decisions that are made by the city council.
Mm-hmm.
So how does, you know, not having that, being elected by a particular region, how does that impact outcomes? I think especially what comes to mind is the conversation around neighborhood associations.
Yeah. I mean, it leads, well, kind of twofold. In one way, it leaves the loudest voices in the room being the people who got those commissioners into office, which are often the people with the most money, and is inherently a little inequitable. At the same time, there are solutions that are attempted to be made across the city to find regional representation, which is through neighborhood associations, and which Portland has over 100 neighborhood associations, which is uncommon and kind of shows how badly maybe different parts of the city want to have their voices being heard. Those neighborhood associations have more power than I think a classic neighborhood group because of, at least right now, their current relationship with city commissioners. They're allowed to kind of lobby directly to the city government and kind of build these relationships. At the same time, there's no term limits to being a neighborhood association leader. A lot of people leading the most powerful neighborhood associations are people who are traditionally upper middle class and white and probably over the age of 50. And has inspired within the city another conversation of, okay, maybe we should restructure the way our neighborhoods are represented, which is just another example of how, like, the city is trying to fix the problem.
Band-aiding it
with these, like, really complicated and contentious other options.
You are listening to a day of special programming, Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years. I've been speaking with Alex Zielinski, the news editor of the Portland Mercury. We've been talking about the major changes in City Hall in the last 3 years. Portland politics and some of their quirkier qualities owe a lot to its somewhat bizarre commission style of government. Instead of a district-based election like the Oregon House of Representatives, Portland's leadership is elected at large, meaning by the whole city. And their powers are much broader than your average city councilor. They possess legislative, administrative, and quasi-judicial powers, as each commissioner oversees certain city bureaus, the mayor included. For example, Commissioner Chloe Udaly, who we talked about earlier, oversees the Office of Community and Civic Life, as well as the Portland Bureau of Transportation. These structures give way to some consistently troubling results. For one, at-large elections give advantage to those with the money and the means to run a citywide campaign, so upper-class, mostly white men get elected. It also means that regional issues can go unaddressed, since there isn't one person devoted to representing your neighborhood. Portland is the only major city in the United States that still uses a commissioner form of government, though they were popular in the early 1900s. Other places use a council-manager or council-mayor model, which elects city councilors from different districts in the city who make policy decisions that the mayor or the manager must carry out. When we come back, we will discuss what has had the commission government hang around in Portland and the upcoming opportunity to overhaul it. This is a Rose City retrospective. We will return in a moment.
The fools wasting.
That was Sweep Me Off My Feet by Pawn. Let's get back into my conversation with the news editor of the Portland Mercury, Alex Zielinski. Why do we still have it? That's my question.
It's a lot of people in City Hall, a lot of lawmakers and former representatives, they think it's a bad system. But leading a campaign to undo the form of government that city commissioners are a part of, if they let it, it would either, ruin, they'd lose a job because there'd have to be a whole new citywide election. If the mayor brought it up, it would mean, it would look like he was looking for more power or looking for, because the commission form of government is also unique in that there's pretty equitable power across commissioners, including the mayor. And it just calls for a huge restructuring and rewriting of city leadership. I think just the sheer lift of that challenge of, okay, our system of government isn't working. Where do we start? Like, what's the game plan? Do we just scrap everything and kind of follow a new model? Does everyone get fired? I think it's really overwhelming for people who work for the city right now. While it's not unwelcome. So right now there's actually an independent campaign outside of the city that's been brewing to get a measure on the November ballot that would call for an overhaul of the city commission form of government and update it to follow a system that has, more than, I forget what the proposed number is, but far more than five people in city council, a larger number, it would expand city council. You would appoint a city manager who would be, like you said, kind of in charge of the administrative rules and allow city commissioners just to focus on like the politics and legislative duties and would completely kind of rewrite the entire structure of Portland government. And it's unclear if that's going to get enough momentum to get on the ballot, but the fact that there's conversation brewing around it is something. At the same time, if that ballot measure doesn't go through, there's another opportunity next year through the city's charter review system, which is something that happens every few years where city commissioners get to appoint members of the community to sit on this committee to reconsider parts of the city charter, which is like the city constitution kind of, and kind of lawmaking document. And that committee can propose, hey, like we need to rewrite the way that our government is structured. But instead of letting that go to the voters, that would be more in the hands of these few committee members. So either way, it's unclear.
Right, because there was a different ballot initiative back in 2007 to try to change it that
failed.
Lost pretty badly.
Right, and a lot of people say that one lost because it didn't introduce the city manager structure. It was more giving a ton of power to the mayor. Mm. And I think a lot of people were uncomfortable with that shift. It does make more sense, I think, politically for politicians to kind of support a plan that gives administrative power to a city manager who is someone that's not elected.
Not concentrating it in the hands of the mayor, which
is
an option
right,
that you could do, and other cities do.
Yeah, and they do it fine. They do it well. I think Portland tends to not trust their mayors,
right.
At least in the recent history. And so they don't want to... Yeah, and it's just a new idea for Portland. It's something that they're not familiar with, and voters aren't entirely sure how things could be improved with a different form of government without knowing exactly what it could look like. So I think this new iteration of a proposal with taking a little bit more power away from the mayor might be more positive reaction from the community.
Right. And, I mean, would it be accurate to say that the commission style of government perpetuates structural issues that Portland faces?
Yeah, I definitely think it would be. I mean, a lot of these issues with representation and you know, there's so many communities that don't feel like they're represented at all in City Hall, and not just because there's not someone who looks like them on City Council, but because there's no one in their community that's like in their neighborhood and going to neighborhood meetings regularly. You know, a lot of city commissioners try to do that. Like, I think Commissioner Nick Fish was really good at like getting out and going and doing things, but he worked way more than someone should for that job. Like, you shouldn't have to overextend yourself to feel like you're representing the entire city. You know, not everyone should feel like they're acting like the mayor. It makes sense to save energy by appointing different people to be in charge of these different smaller regions.
So, thinking about Portland since Trump was elected, what kind of rises to the level of theme, I guess?
I think Portland likes to think of itself as like the home base of the resistance to Trump in some ways. And I think even our mayor kind of revels in that, even though he's not entirely leading much of it. But Portland has been on the national radar for being, for pushing back on a lot of traditional Trumpish agenda items, from anything from homelessness to sanctuary cities and ICE protests to the way it regards its police. I think it's I think in any kind of the reaction at the local level after the Trump election has been to kind of double down on what action can be taken locally versus, you know, stressing about what is out of people's hands at the national level. Portland's always been well known for its organizing and protests and community level kind of action. I think the Trump election has only further inspired that and kind of recentered a lot of organizing that became kind of complacent after the original Occupy Portland protests.
2011, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to add to this discussion?
Well, I think 2020 has started out in Portland with it's begun more surprising, or it's kind of so 2020 has begun with a brand new police chief. Unexpected departure from an old police chief moving to Philadelphia, and an additional opening on city council to add to three other contested seats on city council. I think leadership-wise, Portland is on a path to like completely new conversations in the new decade that I'm excited about. Also hesitant to embrace, but
what kind of conversations do you mean?
I think conversations around policing, especially. We have a new police chief that's been in the police bureau for a decade, for 20 years, as opposed to our previous chief, who was just here for a couple years and didn't really know the community well. I think we have an opportunity to kind of do more than just. She has an opportunity to like do some long-lasting work and maybe regain some of the trust that's been notoriously lost by Portlanders. I think conversations around the future of what city or the future of Portland and kind of how the city functions, there'll be some fresh air kind of blown into those conversations with new voices. I'm really excited for just new faces and new discussions and continued arguments that end up in some progress.
Very cool. So, I mean, trajectory-wise, that's where you think that we're headed?
I don't even know if that's something. but I have a really hard time at this exact moment in time guessing where we're headed as a city because of so much kind of upheaval and changing of the guard in city council that's going to take place in the next year or so. I think the city itself and the people are only going to become more involved in what's going on in the public. I mean, in City Hall, I think the city continues to grow. City continues to become more diverse, ethnically diverse, just politically diverse. And I think that's only a good thing to a city of our size.
Sweet. Well, Alex, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. In.
That was Alex Zielinski, the news editor of the Portland Mercury, speaking with me about the last 3 years in Portland since the 2016 election. We covered major trends around protest, policing, and homelessness, as well as shifts and historic moments in City Hall. We also discussed the City Commission's style of government and how it reinforces structural issues in the city. As we look ahead into 2020 with elections upcoming, these discussions are important to keep in mind, whether they are a celebration of how far we've come or a reality check for how far we still have yet to go. As Portland tests progressive policies, other cities look to us for guidance in policy and governance. On election night in 2016, a lot of people thought the sky might fall. A lot of others took to the streets for 3 days straight. I hope this program has given you something to think about in 2020. I've been Althea Billings, and you have been listening to a Rose City Retrospective. Thanks for listening.
Oh, sweet lady, running like a stream. You don't look back because you know your hands are clean. You make believe that the past was just a dream. You make believe the past was just a dream. Turn around, turn around, and I will sing for you a song. I don't know where you've been, but you've been gone too long.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of In the Blast Zone, a panel on tar sands by rail on Tuesday, January 21st from 7 to 9 p.m. at Patagonia in Portland. In 2018, the Zenith Energy Oil Terminal opened, the first tar sands by rail export terminal on the West Coast. The Center for a Sustainable Economy hosts this panel discussion with activists fighting tar sands by rail in the Pacific Northwest. Again, that's In the Blast Zone, a panel on tar sands by rail on Tuesday, January 21st from 7 to 9 p.m. at Patagonia, 1106 West Burnside in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm. On the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Chinatown's 5th Annual Lunar New Year Dragon Dance Parade on Saturday, January 25th from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The New Year Dragon Dance Parade to celebrate the Year of the Rat begins at Northwest 3rd and Davis at 11:30 a.m. and ends at the Oregon Historical Society. Live afternoon performances and activities will begin at 1:30 p.m. Again, that's Portland Chinatown's 5th Annual Lunar New Year Dragon Dance Parade on Saturday, January 25th from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The parade begins at Northwest 3rd and Davis at 11:30 a.m. and the activities and performances begin at 1:30 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. Information about the parade route, performers, and sponsors can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. It's 10 o'clock, top of the hour. And coming up a little later in the morning at 11 on stage and studio, Dimae Roberts features the Fertile Ground Citywide Festival of New Works with actress, director, and writer S. Renee Mitchell, And 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan interviews John Weber about his new job as executive director of the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art at the University of Oregon in Eugene. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. Want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming? Then download our mobile app today. And now, as part of the Hindsight 2020 KBOO's Day of Special Programming, we have Totality of Circumstance. It reviews police-community relations over the last 3 years.
Thank you, as always, for listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station. This is an hour-long Hindsight 2020 special of Totality of Circumstances, a show focused on police-community relations from the people's perspective. We're going to spend the majority of the show focusing on the first year or so after the election of 2016, up through the beginning of 2018.